thank you, Matt, for that. And again, I'll just repeat to Matt, it's good to see a lot of old friends here, friends and colleagues from Baghdad at various times over the years. I'm going to make some of the same points as Matt, which is good, because there are areas where we agree, and some of the points which it's quite important to reinforce. But what I'm going to do is really put MOI reform in the context of the Iraqi political process, and in particular pick up from where Matt left off, which was really how we got to where we are, and look at where we might be going to raise some of the political and institutional challenges that we might face in the coming year or two. The starting point, really, and let me just, before I make these remarks, make it quite clear that these, again, are all my own view. I have worked for the British government in Baghdad on these issues. Obviously, everything I say is completely my own view, no relationship to official policy. So, having said that, building and reforming the Iraqi security sector, including the MOI, is still central to our transition strategy. A lot of debate about the new strategy that we've adopted over the last year, but if you go back to the strategy 2003, 2004, the current one, the central part of it still is the assumption that the Iraqi security sector will be capable and willing to police the country. Therefore, wherever we're going in terms of the surge or future policy, that's still a central part of our strategy. However, I think all of us have been involved in Iraq recognised that I would say every single timeline that we have had for security transition since 2003 has failed. Every single timeline we've had has been characterised by over-optimism and frankly, self-delusion in many cases. So I hope we can move on from that point and get to a very realistic assessment of where we can go and where we are likely to be able to go. Now, within the MOI and the police, I will argue, and as Matt had made the point, there has been progress in the last 4 years. What I will address, though, is I will look at progress in three levels. One is technical proficiency, which a lot of the debate focuses on, numbers, equipment, and so on. Secondly, institutional development. And thirdly, where I really want to focus my remarks, on politics, because the politics of reform and institution building, which is the hardest and the trickiest. Let's just, to reinforce some of Matt's points, understand the MOI and the Iraqi police. At the technical level, the previous tasks of this ministry and the civil police, on the whole, before 2003, was civil government, a lot of responsibility for public works in the provinces, so basically civil construction projects in the provinces, and low-level policing in a very stable political environment. It did have agencies involved in political policing and security policing. Those agencies were abolished by the coalition. But all the serious security tasks, as we know, were undertaken by other secret police and security and military agencies. So the new tasks of this ministry that it has now are light years removed. It also has a very low skills base. And Matt made the point that a lot of the skilled professionals in it have left or been removed or been killed. That's true. But it does have a core of career police officers who've been in the police for 20, 30 years. But frankly, their skills level is pretty low, even compared to many other Arab countries, given what they had to deal with. So the technical level, what the ministry has been asked to do now is light years away from what the police professionals used to do in Iraq. At the institutional level, let's also remember that the ministry really, in many ways, used to be a bureaucratic backwater. It carried out routine administration of possibly 60,000 people, but particularly during the decade or so of sanctions, the administrative capabilities of this ministry, like all others in Iraq, was hollowed out and weakened. It's now managing possibly 400,000 or so in a very complex environment. So again, just keep some of those figures in mind and consider any institutional transformation, any ministry, any corporation, which has to grow by that amount without its administrative infrastructure changing, and it'll give you an indication of just what the problems are for the ministry. Again, and if you think the DHS is disorganised here, just look at the MOI, and it's a much harder problem. At the political level, again, I'll reinforce my point, and Matt's already quoted me, it's a good way to think about the ministry is that it's been both at the centre of the political power struggle in Iraq. It's been where the political power struggle, some of the political power struggle has been fought out, and you can see that between deputy ministers, for example, and it's also been a prize for the political infighting. So at three levels, technical, institutional and political, we have these challenges. Now, a couple of remarks on the political environment. Again, I'll give you my assessment here of some of the key factors affecting the political environment going forward, and then link those through into institutional reform in the ministry and the police. I don't need to talk a great deal more about the surge. Many of you are much more involved in that debate than I will be. But let me make a couple of points about the surge strategy, which affect the ministry. A couple of key elements of the surge strategy which really affect the ministry. One was a change from seeing the government of Iraq as the solution to seeing it as one part of the problem. Much of our strategy before what we now call the surge, was an attempt to fit Iraq into a classic counterinsurgency strategy. There was a government which was on our side, we were supporting, and there were insurgents which we would build a government to support, to oppose. We realised, particularly under the leadership of General Giono late in 2006, that there wasn't the right way to conceive of the struggle. In fact, the government of Iraq was one part of the problem, one of the competitors for power. So what we tried to do over the last year, in addition to the security activities, is use our resources to fairly intrusively shape the Iraqi political landscape at various different levels. The second key element, and that will I'll come on to what that means for the ministry. And the second part, which again I think is more publicly known, is this attempt to bring together bottom-up and top-down steps of political accommodation. And that obviously has an impact on the ministry as well, in terms of bringing in some of the new groups. Now, lots of debate and lots of very good papers written by many of you in this room on possible post-surge strategies. But let me just look ahead a couple of years and see where we might be and then work backwards from there. If you look back from 2010, let's assume there is a new government in Baghdad, may well be one here as well, but certainly in Baghdad. The core of our strategy, I suggest, will be the same. What we'll have been trying to do between now and then is to shrink the number of groups competing for power outside the political process, i.e. through violence, and bring them into the political process. Now, we don't know whether the Iraqi government that emerges 2010 will be a national unity government involving most of the parties, including some of the new Sunni groups, or whether by that stage the parties will accept the notion of a loyal opposition. So some of the political parties will be in opposition, but accept that they are in opposition in parliament rather than on the streets. But a key part of that work in the next couple of years, which has been started over the last year, has been to try to reduce the influence of ISKI and BADA and DAWA in favour of other groups, particularly some of the emerging Sunni representatives through some of the new Sunni paramilitary and political movements. The whole point of much of the work on provincial elections, of course, let alone national elections or the Concerned Local Citizen programmes, is to bring in some of those groups into government, into the security forces, and reduce the stranglehold on power of some of the key Shiite political parties. Where we go on SADA, we're not sure yet, but I'll come back to that. So if that's a key part of our political strategy over the next couple of years, it will also obviously be underpinned by an ongoing attempt to build a more capable state through delivery of law and order, through the security force capacity building, and through service delivery in other areas. That political strategy has quite a significant implications for building the MOI and the police. Where have we got to so far? I would very broadly characterise what happened between 2003 and 2006 was that partly on purpose and partly by default, we dismantled existing power structures and we encouraged, or in some cases simply allowed, as I say, some of these parties such as ISKI, BADA and DAWA, as well as the Kurdish parties, to take power and to embed themselves in the state as well as in the security forces. Last year, 2007, has been a transitional year in that we did make various efforts to reduce the role of ISKI and DAWA and to get them to share resources and so forth. That, I'll come back to the implications of that for the ministry. Now, if we look at where the ministry is now, where it's going, looking at the three lenses, technical proficiency, institutional development, and the politics. Technical proficiency, there's a great deal written about, whether it's in official reports or whether it's in reports that academics and others put out. And I won't go through the issue of numbers, training, equipment, and so forth. There's a good debate to be had, of course, a very lively debate about what the numbers mean, how good the training is, and we can come back to that. I don't want to focus on that for now, though. Overall, though, I would argue that at a technical level, in their basically ability to operate as a police force, as an internal security force, there has been progress in most areas of the ministry and internal security forces, but we're a long way off where the ministry wants to be or where we want it to be. So there's no question that both the government of Iraq, increasingly, which now has the revenues and many of the skills, and the coalition are going to need to keep investing for a very long time. In terms of the structure of our approach to it, we have obviously over the last year changed course to a degree. Under General Casey and General Abizaid, there was a rush to transition. We were trying to thrust very unrealistic tasks on the police and the ministry. We still have a tendency to do that, understandably. We have rode back on that to some extent over the last year, but we're still thrusting, I think, far too many tasks on the police and the MOI. The other element, of course, of our assistance, which is Bob and others will know very well from many missions, is, as usual, we continue to put far more effort into the Army and the Defence Ministry rather than in the police. Remember, the effort is not just measured by dollars in terms of the aid that goes into it, but also the time. The fact that most of the combat units are partnering quite effectively in some cases with Iraqi Army units provides them with a great deal of capacity building support, which isn't really costed. We don't really have the resources to do that sort of partnering with the police. And as usual, again, we haven't really supported the rule of law institutions in Iraq, the justice sector, in an effective manner. So again, as with so many other of these sorts of missions, we are ending up with an army and an MOD, which are becoming more technically effective, but of course police and the justice institutions are lagging. No surprise there, but it's a mistake we keep making. And finally, on the technical proficiency side, echo Matt's point. A lot of assistance has gone in from the coalition, particularly the US, but frankly, our capacity to deliver this assistance is still woefully lacking. Again, it isn't necessarily a financial issue now. The money is there from the coalition and from the Iraqi government budgets. What it is a question of using that money effectively. And we still find it incredibly difficult to manage, direct, coordinate, and staff our assistance missions out there. We can come back to exactly some solutions for that possibly, but I'd say prioritising and targeting our support is something we still do incredibly badly, although we have learned a little bit over the last couple of years. In terms of institutional development, at the higher level of the ministry, again, I would say there's been patchy progress. If you look at the ministry now compared to where it was in 2003, I would argue that ministerial capacity to do things that the ministry should be doing, budgeting, planning, resourcing, managing, contracting, command and control, has actually improved. It's still very patchy. It's still very weak. There are a lot of uncertainties there. Matt made the points about CPA 71 and the Provincial Powers Law, the huge uncertainties about the relationship of the ministry with the provinces, and many other uncertainties about the basic legislation the ministry operates on. But in a whole range of ways, the ministry has improved. New legislation has been passed, which allows it to take certain actions, such as discipline police officers. It has improved, say, how it does its basic functions. This year, for the first time since 2003, it does actually have a strategic plan which guides its direction. By next year, it may actually have got around to connecting that strategic plan to budgets, which would be a start point. It doesn't do that yet. So in many ways, you can see the ministry improving, and optimistic or encouragingly, I think what you can also see that while there are thousands of bureaucrats at the centre of the ministry, many of whom are, frankly, a complete waste of time, as you would expect, you do have a cadre now of dozens, I would say, of professional police officers or ex-army officers who are beginning to understand what's required to make a modern ministry function, beginning to gain the skills and knowledge, and with carefully calibrated support from Minister Balani, are beginning to make some of those changes. Again, I wouldn't expect too much. If it's a question of where to set the bar, and I've said for quite a long time that if the Iraqi Interior Ministry at some point in the next 5 to 10 years can approach the effectiveness of the Egyptian Interior Ministry, we'll be doing quite well. Now, that's not saying very much for those of you who know the Egyptian Interior Ministry. Let's set the bar at the right place. Again, in terms of international support, we could do much better at delivering support, and I've come on to in discussions how we could do better. But again, we have to remember there are no quick fixes. And it's not surprising that we constantly look for quick fixes, but there aren't any. Now, going to the question of politics, the political scenario outlined before, how does it affect the ministry? Hopefully, most of you know Iraq quite well, so you'll know that politics runs throughout the security sector in Iraq, of course. The ministries have been carved up on political grounds, and to a very significant extent, like many other Arab countries, these ministries are used as patronage networks and enforcement networks for different political parties, not used necessarily for their ostensible purpose of protecting the state and protecting the people. Again, not very different from many other Arab countries there. So the ministries are carved up on political grounds and used as patronage networks, and matters outlined, and I think many of you know, that within the ministry there was a deliberate carve-up in 2003 between the different political parties within the ministry. I would argue politically necessary at the time. It makes ministerial reform very, very difficult, but probably no choice. Otherwise one party will have the whip hand, which wouldn't really be acceptable. That's at the centre. At the provincial level, of course, we've seen this again in the southern Iraq in the last couple of weeks. I think it's still the case that political affiliation tend to trump professionalism in most cases. So if you look at the police force in Najaf, Karbala, Nasiriya or Kut, local political affiliation tends to be much more important than national affiliation to the ministry. I don't think that will change, particularly with the provincial powers law and decentralisation. There are countervailing pressures. As I say, if you look at the core of the, if you like, the backbone of the ministry, senior officers, middle management in Baghdad and some of the provinces, you do have a cadre there of professional officers, some who are 30-year police officers, some who are more recent, maybe coming from the military. And while, of course, most of them individually will not be brave enough to stand up to political or militia pressure, they are working to try to professionalise the force and to instil some sense of loyalty to Iraq. And we can give examples of that, the ways in which, in a very, very low-key way, they are trying to reduce the scope for militia influence, political infiltration, and so forth. Obviously, they need political top cover from Bolani to do that, but they are trying to do something there. The centre-provincial tug-of-war, I think, is a crucial one that we should come back to. The provincial powers law, Matt has talked about. Quite where that will go, we don't know. The ministry itself hasn't come to terms with this. Minister Bolani and many of the traditional officers would still conceive this as the old-fashioned approach, that they basically should be in charge of the local police. They're trying to work out in practice what it means to have decentralised control over the police. But it hasn't been resolved. Where are we within the ministry in terms of the political balance? I would say where we are at the moment is that there is a stable balance for now, whereby ISKI and BADA and DAWA share political influence in the ministry. And you can look at that in terms of key deputy ministerships or director general roles. And that balance, I think, is stable to a degree, although one of the interesting elements of that is that I think as BADA Corps, or the BADA organisation, as they want to be called now, has come into the light, what you've begun to see is fragmentation to some extent. So even individuals you would think in the ministry are aligned together working for BADA are in fact beginning to fragment so that they no longer have a sort of centralised lock on the ministry. So at the centre, I think that balance is still there. And the third leg to that stool, of course, is the Kurds, who have a bit of an oversight role in the ministry. JAM, Jaish al-Mahdi, obviously has a significant role in some provinces, in the police force and some parts of Baghdad. They don't yet have senior roles in the ministry. Interestingly, if you're looking 5 years ahead, it's a generational change. A lot of new officers are coming into the police. Thousands of new officers are coming into the police and will come out of the police academies in the next few years. Many of those officers are going to be JAM-affiliated or JAM-influenced in some way. Given the state of the Iraqi police, I would suggest the next 5 years there's going to be a lot of accelerated promotion, people getting responsible jobs very quickly as the force expands and as casualties continue to increase. So it may well be that over the next 5 years we do see a generational change where the captains and majors may in fact become more JAM affiliated, unless the professionalism can take over. Within the Sunni areas, of course, the ministry is trying to figure out at the moment how to balance demands from the coalition to bring in some of the concerned local citizens versus the reluctance of the Maliki government to bring these people in as police officers and policemen. I'm not sure where that will go. Certainly at the moment I don't see a great deal of sign that the ministry at the direction of Prime Minister Maliki is going to seriously bring in a lot of these people as officers into the core of the ministry. They may bring them in as low-level policemen in the Sunni provinces. I don't see many of these people rising through the ranks to become key ministry officials, but that will be one indicator to watch. Right, to sum up and tie together thoughts on where the ministry is and the possible impacts of our political strategy, and to point us towards some flashpoints that we can discuss. Our transition plan, whatever we do with coalition troop levels, still depends fundamentally on the MOI and the MOD building their technical institutional capacity to operate, and to operate in a more even-handed political manner, rather than working for one side or another in the civil war. As Matt and I have argued, this is gradually happening. Fits and starts, steps backward, and you can point to huge failings, but given the scale of the challenge, this is slowly, slowly, painfully happening. However, I would suggest that the core of our political strategy, coalition political strategy, the next 2 years, is to some extent to upset the existing power structures at national and local levels. As I said, to squeeze the space for Dawa and ISKI, to bring in some of the other groups, such as some of the Sunni groups. We will be pushing for more Sunni inclusion in the security forces. We have pushed quite hard for prosecution of sectarian officers. We've had some famous defeats there, such as with the Ministry of Health trials, but we will continue to push to some extent for prosecution of sectarian or criminal officers. We should assume, as we're seeing already, the incumbents, the people we have either put in power or allowed to go into power, will use their resources to hold on to power. And therefore I would suggest that our political strategy may well, to some extent, necessarily undermine our strategy to build the capacity of the police and the ISF. Some of the flashpoints there. I would suggest that Dawa, Barda and JAM over the next 18 months will probably intensify their competition for control over elements of the MOI and the police at the centre and in the provinces. I am personally fairly sceptical that the integration of Sunni concerned local citizens into the MOI and the police will go a very long way beyond, as I say, putting people into allowing these people to wear police uniforms in Sunni provinces. I'm curious to know what role the Kurds will retain in the MOI. The Kurds have very little role in the central MOI. They run their own business in the north. They do have an oversight role. They keep an eye on the MOI. I suspect they might be able to retain that, but that's about it. The Facilities Protection Service, as many of you know, is basically a simple guard force, which in many senses became legitimised militias for many of the parties, including JAM. There'll be a big push in the next 18 months to cleanse and purge the Facilities Protection Service as it comes under the ministry. It's going to be quite a challenge for the ministry to actually purge many of the JAM militants for that. I'm not sure that's going to go very far. So you'll have a fairly large JAM element in FPS uniforms. One part which I would argue in Iraq we keep dropping the ball over is the question of intelligence services and their link to the MOI. Numerous intelligence services have been created in Iraq, many by us, many by a number of the Iraqi parties. One senior Iraqi politician once pointed out to me when last year they were in throes of creating another intelligence service that it was just fair because the Americans had one, the Iranians had one, it was only fair that his party had one as well. So we have multiple intelligence services scattered across Iraq, nominally under state control, answerable to many different agencies, foreign and domestic. In relation to the police and the MOI, I've always maintained, as Matt knows, one of our big failures was our ability to help them create an effective domestic intelligence service loyal to the ministry. Instead, we got a Barda Corps intelligence service, which is only now being rescued a little bit from Barda Corps. There's a real issue, I think, over how policing intelligence is done, which we have failed to address properly. And the other flashpoint, of course, as we move towards provincial elections, is the whole question of local centre security relationships. How will that really work? The bottom line, a couple of takeaways for our discussion. Partnership with and technical assistance to the ISF is going to be a long-term program in Iraq. Increasingly, the focus has begun to shift from our side, from the coalition side, but it needs to shift more towards higher-end institutional development. A lot of the lower-level police training that we have been doing, frankly, I think a lot of that has been a waste of time. I've said that to Walt, so he wouldn't be offended to hear me say that if you were here. But increasingly, it's even more of a waste of time. And again, this is a council, it's an optimistic statement, not a pessimistic statement. It's optimistic because if you take the example of police training, you do now have a cadre of a couple of hundred of professional Iraqi trainers in the ministry, mainly in Baghdad, but some of the provinces, who are beginning to think through, they're beginning to be allowed to think through what police training means in Iraq. They are no longer simply taking our slides and translating those and teaching those with coalition mentors. It's a long process, but if you watch some of these officers going through the process of working out exactly what police training means for, let's say, a police lieutenant, learning what Egyptians and Saudis have done, taking some of our best practice, they're beginning to get a hold of this and teach something useful. It's a gradual process, but I think they will get there. So higher-end institutional development will be crucial. Our ability to deliver that is still very poor. There are many ways we can refine that ability, and I think in many senses this is about smaller targeted programs. It's not about large amounts of money. It's not even about large amounts of people. It's about smaller amounts of well-prepared, well-trained people and focusing not on putting bodies in the field, but building capacity and building the human capital of the ministry and the police. It's a different model from simply putting X number of bodies in the field and counting that as your output measure. That's what we've been doing too much of, and that's often a waste of time, money, and resource. We also need to be much more realistic about speed of change. Our timeline, so it's a cliche now to say there's a Baghdad clock and a Washington or a London clock. Cliche has been made many times, quite right. Improving the technical institutional capabilities of the MOI and the police is a very long process in Iraq. It's far longer than the type political or security timeline we have, so we need to be quite realistic what we can achieve. And my last thought, which I throw out provocatively, is that if we continue to go down the road of where our political strategy, I think, should take us in Iraq over the next 18 months, as I say, of squeezing those that we allow to get into power and forcing them to bring in others, such as some of the Sunni groups, that will, however, undermine our institutional building efforts as, once again, the ISF, particularly the MOI and the police, become a crucible where this power struggle is fought out. So bumpy times ahead, I think, in terms of institutional capacity building. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our two presenters for extremely informative and provocative presentations this morning. I'd like to invite the people that are standing in the back to come forward. We have a couple of seats that have opened up here. I think this is a very timely discussion. I'm sure that all of us have read press reports over the last week, disturbing press reports about the performance of the police in Basra, about reports of police deserting, refusing to fight, or taking off their uniforms and joining the other side. And then this morning's article in the Washington Post, allegations that the government forces are simply partisan and not really representing the state at all. So this is a timely subject. We have an extremely well-informed audience this morning. Unfortunately, the Iraq's ambassador to the United States has just left. He had other things to do. But he himself has served as Minister of the Interior at the beginning of the Coalition Provisional Authority. So there are a lot of people here that know a lot about the subject, have had a lot of experience in Iraq. I'd like to invite you now to come and engage in a dialogue and a discussion and ask questions. We would like to capture this part of the program on the record, so I'd ask you to come and speak at the microphones. I'd ask you to bear in mind that we would like to get as many people into this discussion as possible, so invite you to ask questions and not deliver orations. Someone would step to the microphone and start us out. That would be good. We have this room until 12 o'clock when the hotel is going to ask for it back, and so we have some time for a good discussion. And let's start. Paul? Oh, wait a minute. Let me ask you, when you do speak, to identify yourself by name and by organization.
Good morning. I'm Paul Hughes from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and thanks, gentlemen, for your great discussion. It's good to hear some refreshing talk on this issue. We're talking about the police and how to reform them, but one of the key components that I think is glossed over many times is the legal code that the police are supposed to be enforcing. One representative of the parliament told one of my colleagues that we need to also understand that the code that they are trying to enforce is a code that, at least for being on paper, was passed and put into practice by Saddam's regime, that they have not had a chance to really reform the legal code that we're expecting them to enforce. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on where the MOI's head is on this particular issue, and are they reluctant to enforce laws that they know are counter to the new Iraqi democracy, if you want to call it that? Thanks.
Want to start? What?
Do you answer for each one or wrap up several?
No, let's just start. Go ahead.
Yeah. All right. I would say, Paul, it's a very good point. And do I need to go to the microphone or can you hear me?
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
from the MOI's point of view, one of their big concerns has been that the state of confusion about legal codes generally. Whether it's the criminal code, whether it's pensions law, whether it's provincial powers law, whether it's budget law, the whole Iraqi legal system, from their point of view, is a bit of a mess, because they're not sure whether they should be enforcing some Saddam-era legislation, CPA legislation, or more recent legislation. The start point of the MOI, the MOI has a legal office, like a general counsel's office, and they have been quite active in the last 2 years in trying to draft new legislation where new legislation is required, and they've got some new legislation through Parliament now, such as, I say, internal disciplinary codes for the police, and or at least to understand where the existing legislation is, and then to try to roll that out across the ministry and encourage police officers to enforce it. And they've also begun to do some work, for example, to try to work out what international treaties Iraq either is party to or should be party to, and then to review how that impacts on existing legislation. So they are trying to grapple with this quite actively. Their basic starting point is that whatever they decide is the extant law, they will enforce that. And particularly for the criminal codes, that goes back to Saddam-era laws. So they're very happy to enforce existing legislation. In fact, they are very keen and very determined to enforce existing legislation. And that's one of the issues that the coalition often faces. That when the coalition asks them to do something or other, they will often say there is no legislation on this, or the 1979 or 1968 law says we should be doing it this way, and they will not divert from that. So they have no objection to reforming the legal codes. They would like to see more of that done. But they will be very keen to enforce what they think is the code now in each particular area.
Okay. Do we have another question? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jim Beaver with USAID. And I just wanted to ask the two gentlemen if they could comment on the additional elements of the institutional development and rule of law that I guess, Mr. Rathmel, you referred to, but maybe you both have a comment on that, as well as whether it's realistic to expect any elements of civil society to help contribute to accountability of the police forces and give a little bit more respectability to those forces over time. Are there opportunities for some success in some places that disprove the null hypothesis that it can't be done?
Before you answer that, I want to make sure that people can hear in the room. Could everybody hear Andrew when he answered? Very strong voice. Okay. Matt?
I'll just make a brief comment saying there is a possibility The question is whether it's going to be politically enforced and supported. As I mentioned during my talk, Minister Samudai, when he was Ambassador Samudai, when he was minister, set up Inspector General's office. That position, needless to say, has been a political football and has been really undermined in some ways, used for political reasons and things of that such. And this is a unfortunately a teething process that's going through, particularly with this one office where they've been trying to implement it. They have had some success with being able to remove some corrupt officials through it. But again, the rule of law is not going to be implemented as we conceive it at any time in the near future, nor will it ever. It should be how they conceive it, but we should try to be able to help mold it. Again, as Andrew has mentioned in his talk, it's not going to be a quick process. Andrew?
Yeah, I would just say, if you look at internal accountability of the ministry and the police to the ministry through the various mechanisms, internal discipline, IG, IA, there has been some progress on that, back and forth, but there has been some progress on that. External accountability, I would break into two elements. One is really to elected bodies, so the council of ministers, the parliament, provincial councils, and the other one is civil society. In terms of accountability to elected bodies, there's a bit of basic accountability to the council of ministers. There's very little accountability at the moment in any formal sense to other elected bodies. On the other hand, the reality on the ground in the provinces, let alone the provincial powers law, means there is a huge amount of potential accountability to local provincial councils. That, despite a lot of effort in the last 3-4 years, that hasn't been structured in a particular organised way. That's been rather disorganised, but there is accountability there. Accountability to civil society, more generally, in the sort of ways that we like to think about it, I wouldn't frankly put too much effort into it at the moment. I don't think Iraq is ready for that. The Japanese are quite keen on that in Basra at the moment. I'm not sure it's a good investment.
Do we have another question from the floor?
Yes.
Please come to the mic.
I'm Joe Drey with the Department of Justice. A couple of questions. One is that a lot of us in law enforcement believes that the MOI is really a racketeering, influenced, corrupt organization. And if that's half true, if it's a quarter true, how do you proceed with that notion? The second question is, as I understand it, Public Law 136B gives each minister the right of veto of any case coming out of that ministry, be it corruption or whatever. Is there any sense of demarche in this government to repeal those kinds of legal constraints? Thank you.
On the second point first, you're right, this has been an issue, and that law is interpreted different ways, as you know, by different ministers and by Maliki and by us. I've been a bit disappointed, to be honest, that over the last year, although we have set one of our objectives being to encourage this government to take more action against criminal or sectarian actors in its government, you know, we have funded the Law and Order Task Force, we have funded and supported heavily a number of trials of high-profile officials, that I don't think we've expended enough political capital on pushing those through when there has been opposition. Now, it's a difficult balance to strike. I would argue that in general, we probably do have more political capital to spend, we should be spending more, on encouraging the government either to make exceptions to laws, so to allow certain individuals to be tried and then to make sure the trials go through, or indeed to change certain laws. I know, you know, Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus have pushed on this quite hard. I think we should have pushed harder, but on your first point, yes, the MOI, like much of the Iraqi government, frankly, is an organisation for distribution of patronage, for carrying out enforcement operations for individual parties. It's an organisation which distributes corruption in all sorts of ways. In many senses, it's very much like its partners, frankly, in many other Arab countries, if I can put it that way. It's particularly bad in Iraq. And there are many other countries where the institutions are very similar. If you look at the Russian security services, I'd say they operate in a very similar way. So let's be realistic what we're operating on here. You know, this is not an organization which is dedicated to the protection of Iraqi citizens in some even-handed way. It's an institution which is embedded in Iraqi politics in, you know, as we outlined. So where do we go from there? I think you then say, okay, either that's where we are and we try to work with that institution, and where there are those who are trying to change it, you work with them, although you get dirty hands when you're doing it, or you say, which some say with, you know, frustration, well, let's wash our hands of it. But I don't think we're really there with Iraq. So much washing of hands we can do. We have to get our hands dirty and try to fix it where we can.
Just to compliment on that, it's also about, you know, what types of resources we use, which sometimes inadvertently feed into the problem, because we want to give so many resources out that, and we think that they'll be able to provide a positive effect when they'll just get subverted. It's just the way it happens with the training that we've been doing a lot, with certain groups getting trained outside of what we wished, and it feeds the problem. And that's why I think we need to be more dexterous in how we go about things and who we hold resources from. Who do we want to specifically empower? Can we target our resources in a better way? That opens up, I think, a whole host of options that we can then contemplate. Because right now, some of these institutions, in order to root out corruption, are infantile, or it's not there. And so there's other ways, I think, that we can use our resources to be able to reduce that problem, not necessarily fix it from an institutional perspective.
Please.
Hello. I've got a main question. Just how different are...
Could you identify yourself? And
okay.
Pull the mic down.
That's how it. Different are the problems that the Ministry of Interior is facing from all those or all that of the rest of the public sector?
And you are, and where do you come from?
I'm personal here on a personal basis. Wafa Jismani.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Okay, somebody would take...
Yeah, I'd say many of the problems are exactly the same. The politicization, the use of the ministries as patronage networks, the lack of human capital, and the lack of systems and processes, you know, budgeting and so forth, are very, very similar. I think the ministry is obviously different, partly because, you know, it has the ability, the legal ability, to use armed force, and that makes it of interest to the political parties who want to control it. And secondly, the amount of resources. Combination of Iraqi and coalition resources mean that the ministry has a massive amount of resources at its disposal, so it's been able to build a huge patronage network and act as an employment agency in many ways. But I think the fundamental institutional and political problems it faces are just a more extreme version of other ministries.
And also, just to feed on that a bit more, is also what types of direct influence the coalition was able to have with regards to the army as opposed to the police. Up until, I can't remember the exact day, I think it was in 2006, the Ministry of Defense was under the operational control of MNFI. The police have never been under the operational control of MNFI. The National Police, it's been touch and go. I'm not sure exactly where it currently stands. But I know initially the National Police were never under control of them. And that, you know, initially caused... was okay because we had a very close relationship with them, but then was then abused, and they went off and they did their own thing for their own political agenda. So there's that type of embedded relationships that we've had with them from a organizational perspective, and then also the police were utilized more because there just weren't that many advisors embedded with them in comparison to the Ministry of Defense Forces. And it was just provided more opportunities for personal types of patronage and personal types of gain.
Another question?
Hi, my name is Chris Turner. I'm with the USGAO. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. This has been really interesting and useful. Thank you for organizing it. This is a less sexy question. It has to do with sort of logistics as opposed to political intrigue and all the rest, though those are obviously very important issues. Since the beginning of the revamping and increasing the size of the MOI, which began in 03 and 04, primarily the mission of training and equipping MOI forces, especially border forces and forces farther and farther away from Baghdad, has been a DOD mission. And I'm wondering, as the provincial powers law comes into effect and starts affecting a even greater distance from the central ministry, how should DOD adapt as the main training and equipping institution for those MOI forces, especially the provincial and the border forces? And I ask that specifically because the DOD approach so far has been pretty centralized. One, that's because that's the way we do things in this country. Two, it's more efficient in terms of buying and distributing goods and services and training. But this is going to have to change as MOI becomes even more decentralized than it already is. So I'd like to get your perspectives on that, please.
I think a lot of, and we have time in order to prepare ourselves for this. That's why I try to touch on this in my talk, because there will be a massive decentralization effort that will happen. And the question is whether, since the military focuses so much on this, and how much can they then work with the PRTs that will then be involved in this? And I know that relationship is organizationally supposed to be together, but I know it also kind of happens ad hoc out in the field. This is going to be more so important than before, and also more so for a lot of the international police trainers that are down there, to really have a focus on trying. And they're not going to be able to establish the logistical capabilities in order to do this, but to be able to help prepare them and connect them to Baghdad in order to receive these resources. You also have to remember that during the regime, it was Saddam used the tribes a lot for the border security forces. We like to think that, you know, sometimes, well, there was no structure out there. There was. It was a tribal structure of some sort. It might not be something that we know. It might not be something that we fully appreciate, but there was. There should be an effort in order to try to really gain insight on what that system was and to understand it more, and maybe in chances to duplicate with the tribes that were working within these various areas through awakening efforts or whatever. And to not necessarily to do it, but to contemplate, to explore if there's ways of being able to rejuvenate some of those prior relationships.
Yeah, I think two elements to this. Obviously, it's not clear yet in the MOI's mind or anybody's mind what the MOI role will be in a decentralized system. I would say it's fairly clear, though, that many of these functions are going to remain centralized, at least in terms of oversight, so you know, budgeting, personnel management, logistics. While the provinces will have quite a big role, the MOI will still have quite a big role in terms of oversight, standard setting, and so forth. And the functions the MOI is trying to build at the centre will allow it to do that. For example, to you know, inspect training, set training standards, roll out you know, procurement mechanisms which are standardised across the country. The MOI is just beginning to get there in putting its some standards in place at the centre, let alone rolling those out. But over the next 2-3 years, there's no reason why the MOI can't roll out those mechanisms so there are some standardised across the provinces. How we then support that is, going to Matt's point, but doing a lot better job of joining up our missions. Many of you have been involved in this debate for a while will know that, in my opinion, it hasn't really worked. Putting the military in charge both of assistance at the local level and assistance at the national level was necessary in terms of logistics force protection. The model was supposed to be that would therefore be guided by civilian expertise on policing, on institutional functions. That didn't work. That hasn't worked for all sorts of reasons, bureaucratic and personal reasons that we know. With the result that the ministerial capacity building effort at the centre, run by Min Sticky, is often widely disconnected from the capacity building of civilian ministries. And at the provincial level, the police transition teams are often widely disconnected from the PRTs, despite the efforts of you know, good individuals to bring those together. If I don't have much hope now, you know, I've been working in Iraq for a while, bureaucratic re-engineering, if we can find ways to bring those missions back together, at the centre and the provinces, and make sure that where you have good PRT advisors who are still in the field working on issues like budgeting and logistics for civil ministries, that they're actually advising the police transition teams, then that would help. It seems to be remarkably difficult for us to make that happen at the moment. I don't know why.
Thank you, Bill.
Please identify yourself. Thank you.
The Washington Times. Very nice to see you both. I had a question about the resources allocation that you were referring to. You said the types of resources we have provided have sometimes fitted into the problem, or fit into the problem. And you said in training, certain groups are getting trained outside of who we wished. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Sure. I'll just.
And it's good to see you.
Nice to see you too. I'll just use an anecdotal story to kind of explain the problem. In late 2005, I want to say it was October or so of 2005, there was a situation, class of people that were supposed to go through training. And during the same decision-making time, and there were many classes, but this is just this one which highlighted some of the political conflicts that go on within the ministry that highlight and address your question. And the minister at the time was Brian Jarva, was very reluctant towards having this class go through. Very reluctant. And what happened around the time when this decision making was happening was that his brother was then kidnapped. And it was eventually then came out that this class was mainly members of JAM, Solidarity Movement. And after Jobber then conceded, saying, all right, we'll let this class go through, the next day, JAM said they found his brother, and here he is. So this is the type of dynamics that are going on inside the ministry about who's trying to get privilege and being able to, exactly as Andrew was saying, this patronage type of system. And that while we have good intents of trying to be able to train and equip people, there's others that are influencing it, that are infiltrating it for their own means. You know, we've tried to address and correct some of those problems in other areas, like with these awakening movements, Sons of Iraq, Concerned Local Citizens. When we were going back, we saw this problem because many of us who were involved in that effort in 2004, 2005, with this, we tried to say, listen, we saw that problem. We don't want to try to duplicate again. Or what can we do to minimize that problem or mitigate that problem? And so we went about trying to do bats and hides of them, which is to be able to get detailed retinal scans and things like that about who these people are, so that if there are situations that then happen in the future with them, we then can kind of track them back. That wasn't done initially. And so lots of people that we don't know went through the type of training programs. We're trying now, I don't know whether this is happening, I wish Walt was here, maybe you do know, whether that's happening with the training that we're doing right now with the police and the army. It is. Excellent. But that was, again, this is something that we've learned from the experiences and how then our good efforts have been in many ways twisted against us.
Do we have another question? Please.
Hi, I'm Tanim. Can you hear me? Okay, I'm Tanim Laila from the Institute of Hazrat Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. We are committed to peace and human development. It's a research institute. And my question is for Dr. Rothmel. In your concluding speech, you were saying there should be a stronger focus on higher end institutional building. Do you foresee a multidisciplinary or a multi-ministry approach towards that?
I wish we could get ourselves organized to do that. At the moment, as you know, in fact, let's be honest, donor coordination in Iraq is not that bad, really, compared to, say, Afghanistan. Even though those of us in Baghdad complain about it, mainly because donor coordination in Baghdad is mainly about the US, intra-US coordination, which is hard work, but it's not as bad as coordinating lots of donors. That being said, we haven't been able to do a very good job of tying together our various capacity building efforts with civil ministries,
and with the security forces, partly for the reasons I talked about in terms of the military role versus the civil role. There is a lot more scope to do better at tying together and ensure a cross-fertilization between the capacity building work done in civil ministries at the national level and at the provincial level and with the police and the MOI. And I think, again, conceptually, it wouldn't be very difficult to re-engineer our various civil military assistance programs to make those links. For now, they mainly work if good people put their heads together. But there are better ways of doing that, and it would certainly help the security ministries.
I just realized we can move this mic.
Hi, my name's Jason Campbell with Brookings. Had a quick question about the National Police. As you probably recall, back in the latter parts of 06, there was a real concentrated effort to sort of begin to retrain and sort of shake up the National Police to make it a more dependable force. And, you know, there was a real, again, a shakeup of leadership of the division, brigade, battalion levels, as well as a retraining program where they were going to take, I believe, each battalion and sort of send them out to this off-site, well out of Baghdad area where they could kind of focus on being a more trustworthy and dependable unit. And I was wondering if you could speak to some of the benefits that we've reaped as a result of that, as well as some of the deficiencies that still exist despite that effort.
Yes, and as you know, both the U.S. military and the Italian Caribbean Air have been quite active in that program of retraining, reselecting officers, and a number of officers have been moved around. I think there were 2006-07, there were teething troubles with that program. I know the Caribbean Air training had problems at the start, and there were real issues over whether the retraining was actually having any effect. My sense, and there'll be others in the room who I know follow this more closely than I do, my sense is over the last 6 months that has made an impact. Certain officers have been moved sideways. The training and then the operational mentoring in the field has had an impact on the operational capability. So what you've seen overall with the National Police is both an improvement in the technical capability and some improvement in the if you like, the political aspects and the human rights aspects of it. There still is an issue that National Police are not really connected to the ministry. There is at the moment no legislation underpinning the National Police, their roles and responsibilities. Their connections to the rest of the ministry are improving, but they still very much are sitting out there as a separate directorate, not effectively plugged into the ministry. So they could well be institutionalised a lot better through legislation and other means. And again, if you look at the officer corps, increasing numbers of new officers graduating from the police academies are now going into the National Police as their first assignment. And those officers have actually had, by Iraqi standards, reasonably thorough officer cadet training, unlike some of the previous ones who are just recycled special forces guys. So some improvements, but a long way to go.
Just to build off that, that's the ReBlue project, I think, is what you mentioned. There has been a change with them in the sense that they have not been as politicized as they were in the past. But what I saw during my most recent tour, and again, on this most recent tour I was involved in from the end of 2006 throughout 2007, was not with the Ministry of Interior, but with being a political advisor in Baghdad, was that when the National Police, though, were then deployed in certain areas, regardless of what types of actual actions that they were engaged in, what types of missions they were engaged in, they still had that perception of fear that it really perpetuated in a lot of the districts that they were deployed to. And that was a real problem that we had to address, a real problem. And that will be one that will continue for a while, that perception of what they then had become throughout the end of 2005 and 2006. And so it's more than just being able to re-blue them, give them new uniforms or do whatever. It's going to be a time type of thing, and they're going to have to redefine themselves reintroduced themselves in many ways for a long time in front of the Iraqi people. I'll also say is that what we've also, I think, been trying to do is to alter the mission of what they have. I don't have the details on this. I'm not within CPAT. But I, from what I recall, that there has been a change in trying to make sure that they're not involved in the same types of missions as the Army is. Now, of course, there's they overlap in some ways, but trying to reduce the kinetic mission that they may have. So they're not put into the situation that like the Army is, and trying to have them lean more into public order types of avenues as opposed to military types of avenues. Lean, not necessarily engaging, but lean towards that way.
Next question. I'm Brian Murphy. I serve for an extended period with the CPA Ministry of Justice and with the U.S. Embassy. Thank you for a most engaging, interesting, enlightening discussion. My question, gentlemen, concerns the role, as to whether it's useful, of the inspectors general, particularly the inspector general at the Ministry of the Interior. You spoke about a patronage system, the inference being a good deal of corruption, which I heard about secondhand, at least when I was there. Could you address whether the IGs have been effective, particularly at MOI?
Yeah, I suspect we were there at the same time when Ambassador Bremer had the bright idea of IGs as a way of quickly fixing corruption. There you go. Quickly fixing corruption before the CPA went away. At the time, I had a problem with that process in the sense that IGs are an American construct. A lot of other countries don't have the same mechanism for internal controls. They are not a traditional Iraqi construct, and they were, you know, for the best intentions, cobbled together at the last minute, the last couple of months of the CPA, as a way of quickly addressing corruption without having all the other framework around, the legislative and the investigative and the oversight frameworks, which will be required to make them work. Therefore, what has not surprisingly happened in many ministries is either the IGs have been marginalized or politicized, or they've been taken up and basically become internal intelligence services. And if you talk to a lot of Iraqi officials in Arabic, they will often refer to the IGs as the Muhabarat, the intelligence guys. And the intelligence guys, the IG, must sit in on meetings on whatever it happens to be, contracting or personnel, just like the old intelligence guys used to. So they, in many senses, have been reinterpreted through an Iraqi lens. Now, in some ways, that's good because, you know, if the intelligence guys that keep an eye on things, well, that's what you want the IG to do, but it's not really the model that we intended. Within the ministry, as Matt said, you know, you've really got, I would say, three internal control mechanisms, formal ones. The IG, which has been a political football, has gone up and down. The internal affairs, and now the legal officers and the internal disciplinary system. The internal affairs section in the ministry, in many ways, has been a success story, partly due to the courage of certain individuals who've run it. And with political backing, they have been quite effective at rooting out certain criminal and corrupt officers, although there are certain people they can't touch. IG, I think, has been of much more limited impact and has been much more tied into political agendas. It's been used at times to investigate individuals on corruption charges, where there has been no corruption, it's been a political agenda. At other times, it has carried out useful investigations. The IGs, though, don't do what IGs were supposed to do, which is proactively look at standards and processes and systems. They have been used for investigation, just like internal affairs. And then I say in the ministry, this new internal disciplinary system, internal court system they're building, I think will be a third leg. And that could actually work quite well, because there's a whole court system and Iraqi-generated legislation underpinning it, which it wasn't for IGs. So my sense is that in all the ministries, let alone the MOI, IGs haven't worked out as we intended. Not surprising, really. How valuable they are at the moment, my own jury will be out on that, frankly.
Do we have another question? Please come to the mic, or just you can speak before you answer.
Very informative. My name is Faribor Frank Fouladi from Procurement USA, Inc.
We are designing free trade zones from Maryland. We are designing free trade zones in Afghanistan and potentially in Iraq. I was wondering how would the local authorities would react to such a proposal, how much concern we have to be for the securities, and how concerned should we for the cultural point of view, and how the government will look at the free trade zones.
I don't know that much about trade. I did my undergraduate honors thesis on NAFTA, and that's about the limit of it. But I would just say that it's important that we just help at this initial stage of just getting trade going back and flourishing within the country, and not just having it be Shias training with Shias or Sunnis being trained Sunnis, but having it being more diverse, at least throughout Baghdad. And that if there is to be a free trade zone, I think that should be something that should be aspired to, but not necessarily something that should be prioritized at this stage, because I fear that if something like that is put in place, again, while it might be a good intent, it will then get utilized and abused for personal gain, and then will frustrate the effort when it actually might be ready a few years down the road, and when it could then be implemented in a much more successful way.
Again, I'm not really a trade expert, so just a couple of observations. I mean, clearly you don't have in Iraq a reliable legal framework for the enforcement of any sort of laws, let alone contract law and what you would need. And at the same time, many of the broader economic reforms, which I think many of us hope to see, aren't really there yet. So if you look at procurement law, obviously the Iraqi state is still the main consumer of goods and services, and they're still operating on a fairly, Arab traditional set of procurement legislation, which means that they have to look first at state-owned enterprises when they're buying goods and services rather than private sector. So I think there's a lot of underpinning changes, which I know people are working on, but which haven't really got very far yet. In terms of free trade zones in particular, the only thought I would have, and after last week's developments in Basra, this may raise a chuckle, is obviously Gordon Brown has put quite a lot of effort into the Basra Development Commission. And at least until last week, the perception was that was making some progress in bringing at least some of the Gulf investors into Basra. Now, whether that still has legs after what's happened over the last couple of weeks, I'm not sure. But obviously Basra, in theory, has the potential to become a trading hub tied into the Gulf Cooperation Council. That may not be realistic anymore. I'm not sure. Well, I don't know. I'm saying certainly Gordon Brown thought it was, but he may have changed his view now. You know.
I want to exercise the prerogative of the chair and ask one final question, because we have 5 minutes left, so we get 2 minutes for the answer. And the question has to do with the Facilities Protection Service, which is a huge force which is supposed to come under the control of the Ministry of the Interior, and I'd like your thoughts on whether that's likely to happen, and if so, when.
Well, it will come under the control, nominal control, of the Interior Ministry. The legislation is beginning to be in place. The training programs and the oversight mechanisms are being set up. But really, the two elements. One is, it's another huge task to give to a ministry which is already way overstretched and under-resourced. So the ministry is going to manage it as poorly as it manages everything else, just because, you know, it's another huge task. So they will struggle to help. And there are some coalition advisors, but again, you know, not very many. So administratively, the ministry will struggle through this in some way. Secondly, though, is the political question. Those Facility Protection Service units, which are loyal to, let's say, JAM, because they come from one of the health ministry or elsewhere, it's then a question. You know, they may well go through training courses, they may well get biometrics taken, their pay may well come from the MOI, but it's then a political question of whether they change their loyalties or whether they can be purged. And that's really a question of government dynamics. Is Maliki willing to stand up to JAM, for example, and make them purge some of their people in the FPSs? That's the political question, which is a separate issue from the institutional side, I think.
I agree with that, and what would be interesting to watch is who is empowered within the ministry with these forces. And I think that will lend credence to where this is going politically and where then we may want to be able to lend some of our influence in being able to help direct that in the right way. Where if this is going to be, if this is a foregone conclusion with it being transitioned over to the Ministry of Interior, where though can we be effective in it? I think that if there is going to be something, of course there is the institutional aspect with Andrew just touched upon, but I also say of how, because each ministry, not each, but many of the ministries out there have these FPSs, and how then are these forces going to be sequenced over to the Ministry of Interior? And I think that's something where we might be able to lend some insights, being able to space out which sectors, which ministries actually then transition them, and to space it out and to think through the effects that each one will have. I don't know whether that's been done yet or not, but that's where I would recommend some of us putting our resources who are there on the ground, because they're not all just one group. They're not all just made up of one group. They're not all just have one set of responsibilities or from one group. There's different ones. And they have different types of effects that we're not necessarily contemplating right now.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank our two panelists for an extraordinarily informative presentation. I'd like to thank all of you for coming on this day before we hear from General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. Damn. I want to invite you to look at the USIP website, where we have published a new paper, which is the result of a series of meetings that have been going on over months about options for future U.S. policy in Iraq. And I'd like to thank you all for coming. We have a series of these forums ongoing, and so watch the USIP website for future ones. Thank you so much.